My name's Sermon Addict.
Hi,
if I sit like this and don't move an inch, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
It's so. Every time I come to this meeting, can you hear me at the back there? Yeah. Every time I come to this meeting, I mean to investigate down there because I don't know what's at the back there. You look a long, long way away. And you're not a mirror, are you? No, you're real people back there. Okay. I really don't know what I'm going to say. I was just sitting here thinking, it's a long time. It's a long time since I've been to a meeting. This is really not right. One of my character defects, which I'm nurturing at the moment, is intolerance. Nurturing, I think. I've given up asking for my character defects to be removed. I've decided to embrace them, to nurture them, and to practice them on a daily basis. One of them is intolerance, and I'm sure there's a couple of people here who would have no difficulty with agreeing to that. I've also got a bit of brain damage, so every now and then I'm going to lose a word and I'm going to start doing like first syllable, like I'm playing charades. Thanks. As I say, I really don't know what I'm going to say. It's over 2 years since I did a chair. It's really a miracle I'm here tonight. A little while ago, I didn't expect to be here. It's not too dramatic to say I didn't expect to be alive. I haven't been at meetings for 2 years. Someone said to me today, you know, when you do your chair, be specific. And I remember when I first came to meetings, people used to talk in this sort of code. And I used to go to this meeting on the King's Road. One of the first meetings I went to, it was on the King's Road, and there was a treatment centre over the road from this meeting venue. And people used to talk about that place over the road. And they used to talk about the other fellowship. And it was a bit like, you know, in the Houses of Parliament, they talk about the other house or something, or they've got a special code for talking about the House of Lords. And I used to think it was like that, that there was this real real sort of secret thing that you could say this and you couldn't say that. And there was another meeting where you went to and people used to say, can you use NA terms? I used to think, what are NA terms? But anyway, I'm not going to use a code. Unless it's something I've made up myself, but I'm going to be specific, and I'm talking about what's going on with me at the moment, and it probably sounds like it's nothing to do with recovery, but I prayed before I left the house today, and I've got to stop horsing around with this microphone, haven't I? Can you fix it, babe? I'm sort of leaning forward.
Just lean forward a bit, and try taking it out. Just hold it. Sometimes that's easier, just give you that.
Is that better? Yeah, okay, so what I feel like I'm going to burst into song with someone. He'd be well sorry. So before I came out this evening, I prayed, and what came to me is this is not about, you know, this is not about me. Like Peter said before, you know, it's not about my ego. It's not about me. It's about me being here as a recovering addict. And if anything I say can help anyone in this room, then I'll be really grateful for that. Because that's what helped me. What helped me coming to meetings, getting that identification. And in order to get that identification, I had to hear people being specific. So people talking about that place over there or this this thing that was going on for them. I'd find myself, I'm very nosy, I'm very curious, and I'd find myself thinking, well, what is this person talking about? You know, they'd go all around the houses to talk about what was going on for them, and what's helped me is when someone's actually said, I've got this issue going on. I was fighting with my husband this morning, or I couldn't get my kid out of bed. And, you know, that was for years in recovery. My struggle was getting my kids up for school. You know, and I wanted to go to meetings, and I wanted to hear someone talking about how they managed that. I never did manage it. You know, I'd go in and I'd be... they did go to school, but it wasn't down to anything I did. I just end up getting really frustrated and screaming. But it helped hearing someone else say, this stuff's hard, life's hard, it's difficult. So before I came out tonight, you know, I prayed, and it was about getting out of my ego, putting myself out of the way, but talking about specifics and what's going on for me. And it's really scary being here tonight, because I haven't been to, in the last 2 years, I've been to... I think, Jace, you said before, I saw you at that convention in Brighton in November 2010. And that was when my life changed dramatically. I got a diagnosis of acute leukemia and basically was told if I didn't start intensive chemotherapy like that day or that week, I'd be dead within months or whatever. And I'd suspected that there was something wrong. You know, we'd gone on holiday, came home from holiday, and I started getting sick, and one illness after another, and had lots of tests and things, until eventually they diagnosed this thing. But, you know, that convention at Brighton was one of the highlights. I was reeling. I was sick. I was really sick. I look at the photographs of me now, and I was like really white and didn't know what was happening. I was frightened. And we rocked up. Nick was speaking. This is my partner who's sitting in the front row here. And he was speaking in Brighton, and we rocked up to this freezing cold race course in Brighton. It was dead seedy. It was... It was a horrible venue. It really was. What we'd done is, you know, I'd been told the day before that if I got sick, I had to go to a hospital right away. If I had a temperature, this and that. Anyway, we booked to stay in this really nice B&B just down the road from this venue. We drove down from London. We live in London, yeah, but this is London, isn't it? Yeah. We live in London. We drove down to Brighton. We got to this venue, this really lovely B&B, and it was closed. There was no one there. I booked it on Expedia about 3 months before. Couldn't get through to anyone. Ended up talking to this poor guy in a call centre in Calcutta or somewhere. And he was asking me for my password on Expedia. We were sitting on a hill. It was snowing. I was about to be diagnosed with cancer. We were sitting on a hill overlooking this race course. This place was closed, and this poor guy in Calcutta was asking me for my password. So I was sitting there, and I was going, he was asking me for my name, and our last name's Mercer. So forget about anonymity, but I was going, it's M for mother, E for... elephant, R for red, C for cunt! Because by this time, I'd lost the plot. And threw my phone down. Meanwhile, Nick's sitting there, and he's going, oh, God. Eventually, we got to this seedy horse racing venue, and there were a few people here now who were here then, and I was able to actually say to people what was going on with me. I was able to be real, to be vulnerable, to say this is what's happening, and And I was scared. And it's such a privilege to be able to go somewhere, to be able to do that. And then Nick shared the story of me and my profanities with this poor man in Calcutta. And everyone laughed because it was really funny. But it was really funny to me because despite all this going on for me, we drove straight back to London. And all the way back to London, I just laughed and laughed and laughed. I don't think I've ever laughed so much in my life. Probably hysteria, but it was something that I was given. But in the midst of everything that was going on, I had that experience of that fellowship. And fellowship, you know, we use that word glibly. It's the fellowship, you know. But I don't see that anywhere else. Or, you know, I don't have that anywhere else. For me, part of my illness of being an addict is my default position is, I don't like you. I don't like you. I don't like you. You know, whatever. Put me in any position, whether it's a party or not a party. Party, you know, I'm the most unsocial person in the world. Put me in a party and I'll certainly won't like you. But put me in any sort of position, introduce me to a new person, immediately my default position is, you don't like me, therefore I don't like you. You know, and I've had to learn, this has been a huge learning process for me over the years, and especially recently, because I've had a lot of time on my hands over the last 2 years. You know, I haven't been going to work, I haven't been coming to meetings. Basically, I've been in quarantine and isolation for the last... I ended up having a bone marrow transplant last July last year. So now I've got the DNA of a 30-year-old Austrian woman. So it's no wonder I'm confused. But I've got a whole new immune system, which hopefully will see me in good stead, and has already seen off these rogue cells that I had. But yeah, my default position is I don't like you. You don't like me. I feel judged whenever I meet somebody. And what I've learned, as I was saying, especially recently, is, you know, I was joking about accepting my character defects, but actually, it really is for me about embracing that, accepting that is my default position. Whenever I meet someone new, whenever I go into a new situation, I immediately go into fear. And when I go into fear, I start judging. But I don't know that's happening. All I know is I don't like you, and I'm sure you don't like me. So what I do is I think, oh yeah, that's my default position, and it passes. And what happens is, you know, I'll meet somebody new, and this can be like talking, this can be like someone serving me in a shop or a cafe or something. I'll meet someone new, and I'll immediately think, yeah, I don't like you, you don't like me. And then I give it a few minutes and it changes. It changes, and I'm able to come into my grown up, because I think I hear people talking about the addiction and how it works for them. And how it works for me, my addiction is I'm impulsive. I don't think things through. You know, Peter was talking before about writing things down. And I was sort of thinking, you know, because I've had a few weeks to think about doing this chair. And I thought, oh, shall I write notes? Shall I do that? You know. And the fact is, I've never done that. My profession is my sort of job is that I have to write notes and things. And I write the barest of notes, you know, like little jotting things down. But the reality is, I'm a very impulsive person. I like to think of it as being intuitive. So if I've written something down, then it would be really difficult for me to say it, because somehow if I've written it down, somehow it's wrong if I've written it down. or not wrong, but it's not, it won't be spontaneous. So I don't know where I'm going there, but that is part of my illness for me, that I can't, it's difficult for me to plan things. It's difficult for me to plan anything. And yet, having said that, it's this, once I start pontificating, which I think I'm in danger of doing now, and talking about sort of having philosophical discussions about how my head works, then the reality is I'm about to start losing myself up my own arse. You know, I didn't come to NA to learn to be a public speaker. I have done. I've learned. You know, when I first came to meetings, I'd sit in that cold, dingy room in Finsbury Park. I'd sit there, and I usually had a carton of Ribena with me. I don't know why, everyone used to drink Ribena in those days, and I'd have a carton of Ribena with me. And they always had a straw in it. We didn't have water in those days, we had all this sugar. My teeth were bad as well. That was one of the first things I did in recovery, was to actually go to the dentist, where I hadn't been for years, and I was so petrified of going to the dentist. I had to sit in the dentist's waiting room saying the Serenity Prayer over and over again, just to get to the dentist. But I'd sit there in the meeting at Finsbury Park with this carton of orange juice, sucking the straw, and it'd make that terrible farting sound. Not like that, clean drink of water. And I'd be convinced that everyone was looking at me. I mean, they were probably looking at me because I had these two little kids with me, one of whom was totally hyperactive and was climbing all over the tables and doing a clog dance under the table and ripping up literature and sticking it down the back of the guy who was doing the chair's neck. Because that's what, you know, I got clean in the rooms. I got clean in NA in 1988. I was 24 years clean in June this year. Thank you, and some of you probably weren't even born then. And I wasn't young when I got clean. I was 35 when I got clean. And I had my 60th birthday last week.
Thanks.
So in the last year, I've had a new DNA, a new chance to live. We've become grandparents, and I've celebrated being 60. And a few years ago, you know, I found myself going around a few years ago thinking, oh God, I don't want to get old. I'm going to be 60 in a few years' time. That's like old. I don't want to be old. And then, you know, suddenly I found myself in Hammersmith Hospital, in this isolation ward, with this central line in and having chemo and bald and skinny. It was actually, I quite liked that look of being bald and skinny. I look like an alien. There's lots of pictures of me on Facebook, and I keep looking at them thinking, I'm fat now. But please, I don't want to go back to having the chemo. But I found myself in that hospital room thinking, What was I thinking? I don't want to be 60, I don't want to be old. Please God, you know, I want the privilege of living longer. I want to, you know, I want to live. And that was the first time, you know, I realised that most of my life I'd been ambivalent about living. And to me that's a lot of what my addiction was about. Was there ambivalence about living? I was ambivalent about living before I was even born. You know, they tell my mother I was dead before, when she was pregnant with me. I was born early, I was in an incubator, I was very sick. And to me, now, I think these are all signs that I was never quite sure that I wanted to be here. And certainly using, you know, for I sort of look back now at my years thing and think that the risks I took, that the steps I've taken over the last 2 years to live, to sort out my health. You know, and I've done a lot. I've done, I've done alternative things as well as conventional treatment. I've done a lot to make sure that I live. Yet when I was using, I caught hepatitis C, which was something else that when I was diagnosed with this leukemia, basically they said to me, because you've got an iffy liver anyway, you're not going to be able to stand the treatment. Little did they know, they didn't understand that addicts, certainly this addict, and I think a lot of other addicts, were very tough people, and I hear miracles every day in these rooms and from people in this fellowship that were very, if we can come through the tyranny of active addiction, someone like me, and I use chaotically, I always say I mightn't have used, other people might have used more drugs than me. I was very good at withdrawing. I spent a lot of time lying on my sofa when I was using. But, that insanity of using those sticky needles in yourself, sharing needles, risking infections, I injected when I was pregnant. These things that I look back now and think, that is the powerlessness of active addiction. And it didn't start off like that. Like most people I hear, I started using because it made me feel good. Because for whatever reason, I was a person, I was a child, I was a young person who didn't feel good about herself. I always felt, that default position I was talking about earlier, that you don't like me, I don't like you. Well, that was really hard growing up. It's a lot easier when you're my age. But when you're a kid and you think people don't like you and you don't like them and you don't fit in, because I never fit in. I was saying last night we were watching this thing, about London. We were watching this programme last night about London. And I was great, it did go on quite a bit, but it started off in the trenches or something in Edwardian times, and it was really interesting for me seeing London in those days. But then by the time it got to the 70s, sort of 3 hours later, I was like, I'm ready for bed, but also don't tell me about the 70s, because, I've been overtold about the 70s. And for me, I sort of was almost too young to be a hippie, but sort of caught the tail end of sort of hippie stuff. And then I went travelling and came back to Liverpool in the late 70s, and everyone were punks. And I was like, what happened there? I've been living in Texas with sort of Fleetwood Mac and Ry Cooder music and stuff. When I come back to Liverpool and everyone's at Eric's pogoing, and I'm like, I've got a resentment. I've got a huge resentment. And I was so pleased when my son said to me the other day, he said, yeah, some people, mistake punk for think punk was real, it was real life, or words to that effect. And that man. So I've got resentment about not fitting in. And growing up, that was really hard. And so when drugs came along, and I was prescribed some sort of phenobarbital or something when I was about three, because I was a sort of bit of a hyperactive child who didn't sleep and screamed a lot. And looking back, there were lots of reasons for that happening. But at that time, it was thought that, I suppose my family just wanted to... actually, they didn't give me... I remember these drugs being up on the shelf in the kitchen, and me trying to climb up on the shelf to get them. And the other thing I remember from around that age is drinking a bottle of my granddad's cough medicine. And I always remember that feeling. It was like full of chlorodine or something. My grandmother came in the room. I couldn't understand why I was zonked out asleep. This kid who didn't sleep, I was zonked out in the living room at sort of 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then she discovered I'd drunk this the cough medicine. But I discovered, you know, not that early on, but once I started, you know, around 12 and 13, started having bits of cider and stuff, and then eventually, when I was 16, 17, 18, got into smoking dope and acid and stuff like that, I started feeling better about myself, because I started feeling like I fit in. At that time, it was like it was easy to convince yourself in the sort of early 70s that drug use was part of being part of in a sort of elite counterculture, subculture, whatever. You know, we were cool because because not everybody. I always remember when things changed because not everybody took drugs then. I mean, it really was. Just the coolest of us who took drugs in the early 70s in Liverpool. And then it all started changing. You know, we came to London in the in 1980, and by the early 80s, you know, I had a raging heroin habit. And I remember going back to Liverpool, sitting on a bus going downtown one day, nodding out as you do. And these little kids, who must have been about 9 or 10 years of age, going, "Look at her, she's a skaghead." And I was so shocked, because, you know, I came from this elite subculture of cool people who use drugs, and suddenly it's like, that's when all skag kids came in and stuff you read about in the Daily Mail. But I didn't fit in there either. I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere, really. And it's only when I came to meetings, eventually, that I started to feel that I had this fellowship of people who were coming from the same place as me. We mightn't have, you know, we didn't all use the same drugs, we didn't all use them in the same way, but we were all following this program, and we all wanted the same thing, which was freedom from active addiction. And that's what this fellowship gave me. Because I didn't go into treatment. I came to meetings. Somebody that I'd used with came. You know, Peter, you said you went to a meeting in 1984, and I think I went to my first meeting about 84. And I really didn't identify, because I wasn't ready. You know, I went to this meeting. It was quite a small meeting, and everybody looked healthy, happy, well-dressed, and they, you know, they were telling me that they had been like me, and I didn't believe them. And it took me another 4 or 5 years after that to actually get clean, by which time I started to identify, I started to believe that you, and you, what you were saying was true. And that there was hope for me. Because I did it very, very slowly. You know, I went to meetings. I went to meetings for about a year. I was on a methadone script. And I know, you know, methadone doesn't work for everyone. For me, it gave me that stability. I had 2 kids by this stage. For the last 9 months of my methadone script, I didn't use on top of it. I used the methadone and went to meetings. I went to meetings and I sat there and I never opened my mouth. I sat there and I listened. By the time I got to one day clean, you know, I'd worked all the steps in my head. I'd had several sponsors. I was 15 years clean. You know, I did all this. Sitting in meetings, listening to what people shared about. And the people, You know, there weren't people with a great deal of clean time in those days, but the people that really gave me hope were people who shared about how that they'd managed to get one day clean. Because I knew I could get one day clean, but I thought I'd be withdrawing, I thought I'd feel sick, I thought I'd be ill, I thought I wouldn't be able to do anything, and I thought I had to use drugs in order to look after my kids, to do what I needed to do. And I learned from coming to meetings, from listening, from following the suggestions, that all I had to do was stop using and everything else, a day's a time, followed. And I was so grateful, you know, that day on the 6th of June 1988, when it was a Sunday, and I went to Blackfriars meeting. There was a meeting on in Blackfriars in those days. And it was a very scary meeting. There were all these sort of young men who seemed to wear black polo neck sweaters. And all talk, they were like, I always thought they were like the NA lawyers or something. And it was a very serious meeting with all these. And, you know, I look back now and I think, you know, a lot of these people I know now, a lot of these people are still around. And I look at them and I think, you know, that guy was like 23 or something. But the gratitude I felt of going to that meeting and knowing that I hadn't used that day. I still couldn't open my mouth. I couldn't put my hand for a one-day key ring. But I knew that I hadn't used that day, and that was my first day clean. And a day at a time, it got better, and it really did. You know, I didn't sleep. I didn't sleep last night. What's changed? But I didn't sleep in those early days of recovery. But each night, you know, I'd sleep maybe half an hour longer until after the end of a few months I was sleeping. And that was proof to me that it got better. And slowly, you know, slowly over time, my circumstances changed. My husband got into recovery. Look, I was living with a using addict. I had two kids. I was on this methadone script. My life was shit, basically. And it's not now. It's not now, and it hasn't been for a long time. It got better when I got clean. And, you know, miracle for me, my husband got clean. He got into recovery. And that, you know, that's the whole, you know, how do I sum up 24 years in recovery? Well, I don't accept to say that I'm so grateful to this fellowship that's always been here for me, and that, you know, I follow the suggestions, I come to meetings, I show up, and that means showing up with whatever it is that's been going on for me. And this has been like, you know, obviously the leukemia and the transplant have been a huge thing for me. And, you know, my meetings were all done on my Facebook page when I was in hospital in quarantine. There's people here who are part of that support group. And, you know, I've got other people, other friends who aren't in recovery, people I've worked with, family members. And, you know, they've all said to me, because they've been so amazed at seeing all this support I've got from people in the fellowship and other people who aren't in recovery, I think are in awe of that. And, you know, there's nothing like it. So if you are new around, and it's hard. It's really hard putting down the drugs. No one, you know, I use drugs for a reason. I use drugs because initially they made me feel better about who I thought I was. Then, you know, they made me feel shit, because not only, you know, shame for me, shame is a big thing about. Shame is a huge component of my addiction. Shame about who I am. Who I think I am. And when I was using, that was compounded by using drugs. Especially when you've got kids and, you know, and you've got to go up to school and that. So that shame about who I am made me have to take drugs on a daily basis. But then when I stopped, when I started coming to meetings, when I got into recovery, although I didn't entirely let go of that shame, I understood that it wasn't just something that I heard, it was something that you heard, and that you heard, and you heard, and you heard. And it's not true. It's not true. It's something we made up about ourselves. And I thought drugs would stop me feeling that. And they didn't. They just compounded it, made it worse. But recovery and this program and coming to meetings and following the suggestions and showing up and being in this fellowship does really work. And it's very simple. So if I hope that's made sense. I hope that made sense. But I am so grateful to be here, and I'm particularly grateful given what's happened the last 2 years. Just grateful to be going into my 61st year and to be able, you know, where's that shame gone that I can sit here and say, you know, if you told me a couple of years ago that I'd be sitting at a meeting going, yeah, I'm 60 with white hair, you know, because now that I've got this new white hair, because it used to be sort of, you know, I'd colour it all the time in case people saw how I had grey hair and thought I was old. But if you told me, I'd be sitting at a meeting saying, yeah, I'm 60, I'm a grandma, and miracle of recovery. And just finally end on this, because it is, it's miracle after miracle. And, you know, when I first got sick and I was in this isolation room, I had this vision board up on the wall, and I put all these things on this wall that I wanted. And one of them was like a big cat. I wanted this big cat. One of them was enough money to be able to not worry about money when I was sick. And another one was a baby, a grandchild. And neither of my sons were in relationships or anything. And I said to them, you know, just get on with it. I want a grandchild. And one of my sons obliged. But I knew before he told me, because I dreamt, that, you know, he'd come to me and he said he was going to be a father. And about 6 weeks later, he came to me and he said, I've got something to tell you. And I said, I know what you're going to tell me. And I told him my dream. And another miracle of recovery. So thanks for asking me to do the chair, Ali. And thanks for this meeting, and thanks for being here. I'm very grateful, Addict. Thank you.